Shrink Wrap Radio number 770, Finding the Face of the Hero with naturalist Bernie Taylor.
And now it's time for Dr. Dave and Shrink Wrap Radio.
You're on the couch again with Dr. Dave. And Shrink Wrap Radio is playing on again. Yeah. It's all in your head. It's all in your head. Shrink Wrap Radio. Shrink Wrap Radio. Shrink Wrap Radio. Shrink Wrap Radio.
It's Shrink Wrap Radio. All the psychology you need to know, and just enough to make it dangerous. It's all in your head. And now here's your host, Dr. Dave.
My guest today, Bernie J. Taylor, is an independent naturalist, thought leader, and author whose research explores the mythological connections and biological knowledge among prehistoric, indigenous, and ancient peoples. We'll be discussing his work and his book, Before Orion, Finding the Face of the Hero. Now, here's the interview. Bernie J. Taylor, welcome to Shrink Wrap Radio.
Well, David, thank you for having me as well.
Yeah, well, it's great to have you on the show. We're going to be discussing your very thought-provoking book, Before Orion, Finding the Face of the Hero. That title really grabbed me, you know, Finding the Face of the Hero. You describe yourself as a naturalist, and I gather that term has a lot of specific meaning to you. So maybe you can kind of unpack it for us.
Absolutely. So you're familiar with many naturalists in the world. One of them, of course, is Jane Goodall. Jane Goodall went out into the field, into the Gombe Forest, and she connected with the animals, and she connected also with the rocks and the trees around her. So she became an animist of sorts. Teddy Roosevelt, another naturalist, a hunter, great hunter, who saw that we need to preserve the forests and the rivers, so create a national forest system. So the naturalist is somebody who takes a larger perspective of the environment. So the naturalist doesn't look at, you know, guinea pigs in the lab. The naturalist doesn't look at, you know, how many times the eye blinks when the light is shining on it. The naturalist looks at a large perspective. And I came into this sphere, this now Jungian arena, by coming it through a person who spent a lot of times out in the woods, in the field, but also a person who read a lot. I read a lot of biology books. Of course, there's a lot of training before that. And so I came to this, and I was studying the question of why do animals, in my case, it was salmon and birds, why do they migrate earlier or later from one year to the next?
Yeah.
And it was an unasked question in wildlife biological circles. And I attacked it through perspective of chronobiology, light and dark cycles. And I worked with Oregon Fish and Wildlife biologists, and we organized the data, and we found out that the animals are actually, the salmon are never early or late. They're just not on the calendar that we use. Uh-huh. And that was the essence of the work I did about 20 years ago.
Wow.
And that led me to Native Americans and their calendars, which of course are different from ours, and it projects the timing of the animals. They're never early or late. They're on the animal's timing. And that was, I did that about 20 years ago, and that work then became sort of a procedure or a standard in wildlife biology circles. And then I said, I put it aside for 10 years, and then it came back. And when I came back, I looked at new caves that were open, newly dated from different perspectives, and I saw, oh my God, there's something else in here.
Okay, and before we go there, yes. I want to ask you, you and I both share an interest in Carl Jung, Joseph Campbell, yes. Journey of the Hero, and all of that. Which came first for you, this involvement with nature or the Jungian, Campbellian stuff?
The involvement with nature. So the Jungian Campbellian side didn't come until 6 years ago. I had taken Myers-Briggs tests, right? I'd read other people's Myers-Briggs tests. So I knew the business side of Jung. But from the perspective of unconscious and animus, these were entirely new things to me. And when I walked into this and I saw things that people hadn't actually recognized before, I said, well, why is this so? What is the structure of this? How come we have been doing these things for such a long period of time? And we do it today. We did it in the cave art more than 30,000 years ago. And so I really searched. I went across. And well, Jung had the best. Yeah. Oh, we're going to go there. Okay.
When you first discovered Jung and Campbell, what was it that spoke to you? What stuck out? What grabbed you? For example, the collective unconscious. What did you think of that concept, the collective unconscious? Was there something about it that just grabbed you? Did you have an aha experience about that?
It was when I first saw the collective unconscious versus the personal. I thought the collective unconscious was a voodoo. So I came at this from an empirical standpoint.
Okay.
I was a person who was counting the numbers. When I did that biological clockwork with the salmon and the migrating birds, it was strictly about the numbers. Looked at the Native American calendars, again, about the numbers. And people would tell me stories. Native Americans would tell me stories. And they would just pass over my head. And what I was missing was that it's not about the numbers. And so everything can't be quantified. And that's what I learned from Jung by, stepping slowly into who we are. And so I came in as a skeptic.
Yeah, and that's interesting because in when I was reading your book and listened to some of your interviews, I never got that piece of it. So it's really fascinating to me to learn that you started out as a very natural science empirical guy. And and then you somehow this other material spoke to you and woke you up to another dimension, a broader dimension. So I think that's fascinating. And so your book is very much about these caves in Spain, El Castillo.
Correct.
So tell us about. Take us there, because I know you want to go there. I was holding you back.
So stepping back just a 2 minutes, I was working on this concept of the timing of the salmon and the migrating birds.
Yeah.
And a Native American said to me, maybe you can find more in the Upper Paleolithic caves of Europe, which date before us. And this Native American recognized that the Upper Paleolithic cave artists were very much like Native Americans. And so I looked at the cave images and I went back to the oldest ones that had recently been dated to the mid 30,000 years ago. And I was looking for the numbers. I was counting the numbers on the panels, counting the dots and see how they correlated with the animals. And then I was looking at one panel called the Gallery of Discs. And this is a very young type of moment. And I was just sort of sitting back in my chair and I said, well, that looks like an elephant. And this is the panel with red discs floating across it. So that's the illusion drawn to the red discs, that each red disc with the palm of your hand. And I see this elephant and I say, that's interesting. You know, people see elephants in the clouds. And then I, kind of started thinking about the problem and how to count it. What's the numerical sequence? Then I saw the head of a lion. So that's interesting too. And I said, I also knew something about lions in the cave art is they didn't have manes. So European cave lions have manes, but this one did. And that struck a chord with me. So I contacted someone from my distant past. His name is George Schaller, PhD, and he's the world's foremost wildlife biologist. He's the mentor of Jane Goodall and everybody else in that time. And George, I met him in my mid-20s. I'm 57 next week. And I met him in China, in Beijing, at a business conference. And he didn't remember me. Of course, I remembered him because he was the big deal.
Yeah.
And so I contacted him via email. I said, George, this is what I see. What do you think? And George came back skeptical at first because, of course, there was he knew that lions in Europe didn't have AIDS and so on. And then he said, you know, let's look further at this. And so George and I went through about a year and a half and ultimately came up with on two panels, probably about 80 images of animals. And this is the most important thing about George Shallon. George is a naturalist. He wrote a book, The Life of a Naturalist. And George, I would ask George, well, what time of year is this? What is the lion doing? What is the giraffe doing? And George would come back and say, well, he described it as a tender moment between the mother and the juvenile of the animal. He was giving me answers back that were not in my vocabulary, were not the way I thought. Uh-huh. And so that George moved me towards being the naturalist. I recognize it's about animism, how people are connected in that time with animals or animal beings and their natural world. So I stepped away from the statistician through George, you know, one of the foremost wildlife biologists. Now, going to someone like George is an interesting task. And because if you say to George is like Tiger Woods in the wildlife biology. If you go to Tiger Woods and say, Tiger, you know, what do you think of my putt? And Tiger could say, you know, maybe, you know, putt-putt golf is your game. Or you should think about the pros. Maybe you should get some help. So if you go to George Shaller, it could have gone different ways. Yeah. And George got behind it, which is saying, like Tiger Woods saying, you know, you should go pro.
Yeah, yeah. So he was supporting what you were doing. I want to make sure that people are getting the picture because they don't have your book in front of them with the illustrations and all. So you're going into this El Castillo cave, which I gather, and there are images on the walls that have been stenciled or painted or something.
Maybe engraved and painted, yes.
Yeah, engraved and painted. And depending upon, am I right that depending upon how far back you go in the cave, you see different things, that there are different panels of pictures?
Correct.
Okay.
And that's an interesting point. The orientation. So when I'm discussing these, what we're going to call it, the hero's journey type of images, these are always in the deepest part of the caves. Always. Sometimes one is down in a deep hole.
Yeah.
They're always in the deepest part of the cave. And so when one enters the cave, any of these caves, if you first see, you know, rough sort of stuff, and then you see better art, but you won't see these till you get the deepest part of the cave. So you've had to walk through the juggernaut, the labyrinth, to reach this point. Mm-hmm. And so Jung talked about this concept in his dream. He had a dream. He walked into an old house. And he walks through the hallways and the stucco's coming off and he sees this is, you know, something from, you know, a few hundred years ago. He goes deeper and he sees this looks like it's from Roman or Greek times. Then he goes to the basement of the house and he opens up a latch and he goes down and sees the skulls, I believe. And he says fundamentally, in so many words, the primitive man, which is the animist we say today, the primitive man is still ourself. So I had that same sort of that same Jungian type of journey. Jung journey is that I went deep into I went psychologically deep into this, and I came up and I said, not only was the primitive man an animist, but the animist is still within us, and the animist is the foundation of most of what we believe. We haven't stepped away from the animist, and that's what Jung talked about. Jung talked about a lot of his archetypes. Are very animist. He talks about, you know, the river transformation, the mountains as the two non-organic prominent found in dreams. But he also talks about all these animals that people interact with, you know, the horse, the blackbird, I think it's a tortoise, and the bear, of course. And so people have these animals in their dreams too. And both, so that's the organic, and then inorganic is the body of water and the mountains. Well, that's what we're finding in these, that's what at the deepest part of these caves. That's what the images are.
And
these aren't just.
Yeah. The first That's chapter of your book is The Art of Seeing.
Correct.
And sort of what I got as I read that chapter was that for you, it wasn't just seeing, but rather it was putting yourself into a frame of mind, mm-hmm. going back into the deepest parts of yourself, if you will, and and seeing it through that mind. And these were Neanderthal people, right?
These are Homo sapiens. We have no evidence that Neanderthals created art. These were Homo sapiens 35,000 years ago. These are people that came out of Africa.
I wonder if you know about a study that I came across as a result of, you know, reading your site, and something popped up over in the margin on YouTube, and I ended up following that. And a group of archaeologists at Durham University in the UK have redated it, because your book, it says 43,000 years, and that's impressive.
So there's different panels. This panel is about 35,000 years ago. In that cave system there, the Durham team went to about 40,000 years ago.
This Durham, and I'll send you the link if you'd like.
Yeah.
It was 60,000. They went 62,000 years.
That was debunked. That was debunked.
Really?
It was debunked. Wow. What happened it goes back to the question, how are people dating things to 35, 40,000, or perhaps 65,000 years ago? These panels are all limestone, and calcium carbonate secretes from the limestone. And if there's a cave art image there and the calcium carbonate secretes over, you can say that the image is dated to at least as old as that calcium carbonate, which is uranium series dated. Okay.
Right.
So the panel, this gallery, this panel, multiple points that you're in the mid 30,000 years ago. The one that was you're reflecting on 65,000 years ago, that was a paper came out just about a month ago. I mean, literally a month ago, things changed. And they reexamined the points that they pulled off of the calcium carbonate. And they said that the calcium carbonate for the 65,000 years ago was not on the image, whereas calcium carbonate from a much earlier, much later period, closer to us, was on the image. So I think they ended up like 25,000 years ago. Huh. And the title of the paper was "Still No Evidence for Neanderthal Cave Art."
Oh, really? Okay.
Yeah. And so that's really important about the scientific method, is that it's a method. It's not an absolute truth. And when people talk about Jung, they say, you know, this is voodoo, as I said, and I thought. And this is not quantifiable, but a lot of what we look at it in dating of things in the sciences, things change. You know, before Einstein, there was Newton. Before Newton, there was Aristotle, or Copernicus, then Aristotle. And every one of those were scientific truths. But as we learn more about ourselves and how to put things into context, we come up with better information. Or more complete information.
Yeah.
And so that's what happened with the with the 65,000. And so mine is that all the mid 30s, no one's arguing those. They're not my dates. They were done by the people at Durham, by the author of Pike, was the major author. But yes, there's still no, based on the title of that paper that all the Titans in archaeology signed off on, still no evidence for Neanderthal art. And that raises a big question. Why didn't Neanderthals have art? And we do. And what we did back to at least 40,000 years ago in Europe and 43,000 years ago in Indonesia. And I think that goes back to this concept of the animist. And that how did we first come to find art, and why we projected art in other places is at the essence of this aspect of the human imagination. And it ties back to Jung's archetypes, because our earliest art are of the characters he discusses, and the both organic and non-organic archetypal characters.
So I'm getting a little confused here. I don't know if you're saying animus or you're into
animist, like I'm an animist, an animist, like a human animist, as like a. You can say someone's a shaman. You can say someone's an animist. Another person's a Catholic. So A-N-I-M-I-S-T, so animistic.
Yeah. So I'm losing the animism. You're talking about animism.
Animism.
Yeah, yeah. Because what was confusing is that Jung uses animus and anima as, correct, you know, for men and women, and so that's where I was getting confused. Correct. So we're talking about animism here.
Animism, and that would make hypothetically a naturalist as an animist.
Okay. Yes. Yeah. Okay, so, we're understanding each other now. We're on the same page.
So Jung spoke to this, and he talked about the primitive man, what we now call animism. And that we do the question. So we can say that we have these archetypal characters around the world, especially the cosmic mountain. I mean, it's the river of transformation. We have these. We can say they diffused around the world because I can go back early enough in time, mid 35,000 years ago, that idea of the cosmic mountain, sacred mountain, could have traveled around the world. No doubt about it. The question, though, is why do we still project the cosmic mountain from our dreams and in our art and in our stories, in our mythology, in our movies? We position our homes to see the mountain. We climb the mountain. We take a pit, the cosmic mountain. We pull over the highway to have our pictures taken with the mountain.
Right.
Why do we do that? And so my book takes us so far back in time. So this isn't biblical times and people say, well, you know, Abraham did this and Job did that. This is a long time ago. And we could say, well, it started back then, to carry it and diffused around the world so we still have it. But it still doesn't say why we as the modern man, the modern citizen, why do we still have these dreams? Why do we still pull over on the highway to take our picture?
Yeah, so this brings us back to the idea of the collective unconscious and to archetypes, right?
Yes.
And you're talking about archetypes. And what's your idea about that? I mean, one view of it could be that somehow it's in the genetic code, traces of the past is in our genetic code. And I guess the other is somewhat more spooky than that, not quite so naturalistic of what, that it's from some other dimension, maybe.
Mm-hmm. So in 30 minutes on this program, you have cut to the chase of the biggest the biggest issue is the mountain. And as an inorganic archetype serves no purpose to us in our daily life. And how did we carry to it? And does it go to the collective unconscious or something more spooky? And something more spooky is like people like Akashic records and those sort of stuff. So I'm a no-no on any of that stuff. Okay. So I'm still a realist. Rupert Sheldrake has an interesting idea. You could probably get, he calls it cognitive something. And so he says that rats in Australia and rats in the UK learn from each other. Interesting idea. If you can pull it off, you should get a Nobel Prize. But until that point, I'm not going with those concepts.
Right. You believe in a natural world.
Correct. In a natural world. I believe in a natural world. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So the question is, so you've, of course, we've both read Jung and we've both gone through the collected works and the collective, the work of the collective unconscious is probably about 2.5-3 inches thick, right? Okay. And Jung spoke about a lot of things and he gave a lot of things and he didn't truly have the answer. So he sort of like he circled around it to try to establish the theory of what it could be, as opposed to saying, this is what it is. This is how it works.
Okay. Right.
So now, as a psychoanalyst, you're now asking a common man what he thinks of what is the collective unconscious and how does it work? So I think there's elements. And there's reinforcing elements. So one element is that we do have a diffusion around the world of mythology. We have common characters, you know, the hero, the apprentice, the mother, the child, these sort of things. So those are things that are part of our lives and they structure the stories as they move forwards. And so that accounts for I would describe as the personality type archetypes. But what's the cosmic mountain is an interesting one, because where mountains don't exist, so for example, the Mayans, they built these pyramidal shapes. Where mountains didn't exist in Egypt, they built the pyramids. And when they stopped building the pyramids, they went to another area and they built tunnels into the into a mountain that at the top looks pyramidal shaped. So where there are not mountains, we build mountains. We actually build mountains. Okay. And that's, and where, you know, any kid's going to draw, you know, paint, the first painting is probably going to be a river and a mountain in the background. So why do we do that? Well, we discussed earlier, I live in Westland, Oregon, just outside of Portland. And out of six windows in this house, including the two behind me, I can see Mount Hood. Those windows and all the ones in this cul-de-sac here were all architected, if that's the correct word, structured so that we could see Mount Hood through our front windows. And when we look at Mount Hood through our front windows, we see something piercing the sky, the highest point. Eliade had a word for this, that we connect the earthly world to the sky world, and it stands out against the blue sky, which we have most of the time in the summer in Oregon here. So it's something different. It's something that strikes at the imagination, and it carries us skyward. It truly carries us skyward. So it's something different from the norm. It's something different. And it's a different plane from the terrestrial plane that we normally dwell on. Okay. So if we take that concept of something is different in our world, and we combine, and then we have these myths and these stories and these other images in our head, we then connect to that mountain, and it becomes part of our collective unconscious. So my perspective is that I'm not a fan of epigenetics. Okay. I'm not a fan of epigenetics because I think that you can answer the question through, science and reason in a sense. Okay. I think we can answer it through diffusion, what we see that's different in our world. So hypothetically, a few weeks ago, we saw we don't live in coyote zone. And a few weeks ago, we saw a pretty big coyote walking up our hill, and apparently all the cats disappeared after that. The coyote in our neighborhood is something different. You know, maybe I could have taken a picture of that. I could have put it on Facebook or tweeted it, that sort of thing. So it's something different, just as the mountain is different in our horizon. And then we choose the highest mountains because they're the ones that are the most significant in our horizon. So I think that what makes the inorganic archetypes of the river and the mountain is that they're different, okay, in our environments. And then that merges or melds with this other history that we have that is what we're told, what we watch, what we've seen, because you can't go anywhere and not see some sort of pyramidal shape, whether it's man-made or a natural mountain. So then the question becomes, and this ties into the hero, the shaman, I mean, the prophet, everybody climbs a cosmic mountain. I mean, you can go through the Bible, you can go, literally everybody climbs a cosmic mountain to meet with the great beyond. So we have this perspective, we have a long-term perspective of the sky world. And that sky world, we can now see that back 35,000 years ago, because we have the images there of the sky, there are the constellations. So that our cosmic mountain becomes that the highest connection we have to the sky world. But today we have spaceships, we have airplanes, we've all flown higher than any mountain we've ever seen. But we still maintain that. So so it has to be somehow deeper. So I'm not going with epigenetics, but that perspective becomes this collective unconscious of all these factors that come together, then perhaps become part of our personal unconscious. So we take ownership of it. We personally take ownership of it. And that's why we go back to look at the mountains. That's why we pull on the side of the highways. And that's why we structure our homes to look at the mountains. So that the archetype becomes the mother and the child, the hero, the villain, the damsel in distress. They're natural life story archetypes. I mean, we all experience them in many different ways. And so they're part, that's part of like the biological process. So these are non-biological, but we can also experience them through our interactions. And I think if Jung had seen what we're looking at now, I believe that he would have come close to the, he would have had a slightly different perspective. And both Jung and Freud were amateur archaeologists. And they went back to ancient Egypt and looked at the artifacts. They were trying to figure out what is the source of this. And now we have more information, you know, many years later, that we can form a common element. So why do we have it in our dreams? Why are we projecting the cosmic mountain, the river transformation in our dreams? And so my question to you as a psychoanalyst, so we have now you on the question block. Why do you
I'm not a psychoanalyst, by the way.
Jungian analyst. Okay.
I'm not a Jungian analyst. I'm a psychologist, but I
You're a psychologist.
Yeah.
So what if you come across somebody that's you ask them to draw a picture, hypothetically, and they draw, you know, a tree, you know, the dead tree, dead mother concept, and then they put a mountain behind it. What is your read on that?
I wouldn't have an idea about it without talking to them and exploring, you know, their sense of what it might, what role it might have in their life. But if I'm following you, I think it's, first of all, I think we have to acknowledge that this is hard stuff to talk about or to nail down in any super precise way. But I hear you saying, or at least this is also my impression, that there are experiences that recur for all of us, all of humankind, that that we resonate with. That that there's something within us that kind of comes alive around that. We're drawn to it. These images end up being in our stories, in the movies that we make, in the dramas we create, and in our pathologies. So I wonder if I can, one connection that you make that we haven't touched on yet is astronomy, that you have a, you talk about astronomy then and now, 34,000 years ago and now, and that you say they're the same.
They're the same, Actually, the Greek astronomy. So what there's been a – astronomers have had a difficult question for many years. And the difficult question is that there's been a series of new introductions of constellations, a series of new ones. And so the Ptolemy, who was a librarian of Alexandria, one of the greatest astronomers, he brought in a whole bunch of constellations that were very – animism, I'm going to tell you. So they're centaurs, and they're there's a merman. All these people integrate with the animals, kind of stuff.
Right.
Okay.
Right.
The monsters.
Yeah, these mythical figures in the sky.
Correct. And so the Draco, the dragon, and one has to ask the question. The Greeks were, you know, we believe that they brought us science and reason. Mechanical engineering, you know, all these great things. Why would they pick up these constellations? All these animism constellations that the Babylonians didn't have. And we have no record that the ancient Egyptians had them. And so astronomers have tried to figure out for a long time, well, where did these come from? And they surmised that there's some mariners. And the mariners were using these for navigation. They transferred around the Mediterranean. Well, my work shows that 15 same animals, creatures, animals, beings in the same order were used in the Upper Paleolithic 35,000 years ago as constellations. So what happened was Greeks and others, perhaps in the Phoenicians, they had traveled to these caves because many of them have the same symbology, and they mined them. They literally mined the caves, and they brought back, you know, mythical characters, the centaur. I have the centaur character in many, many caves. And they found the constellations, and they added them to their own inventory. And they made some changes, small changes here and there, but it is the same characters in the same order in the night sky. And so then they found mythology in this. But here's the difference. The animus and mythology of the Upper Paleolithic is very different than the Greeks, because the Greek hero Orion goes around killing animals, right, in mythology. Whereas in the Upper Paleolithic story, the hero is on a journey, and as he encounters all these animals, the animals assist him, because there he's a fellow animal being. So two different perspectives. And Joseph Campbell sort of talked about this as a concept of the different ages. There are different perspectives. There's animism, there's shamanism, there's the Greek perspective. He had a word for it. And so the Greeks were a warlike people in many ways, whereas the animism of Paleolithic, we see no warlike tendencies at all. And the only animal he actually battles with or kills is the lion, which is, of course, the Nemean lion in a deep, dark cave. So the constellations are the Greeks picked up or mined a whole bunch of the Upper Paleolithic constellations, added to their own inventory. And we can actually use those constellations to actually certify that calcium carbonate dating we talked about before.
Yeah.
Because the Upper Paleolithic cave images, they not just tell the constellations, but they have animals as they are at certain times of the year. So we can date it to the time of the year. And it overlaps within hundreds of years of the calcium carbonate dating. And which is quite extraordinary that they got the calcium carbonate dating correct, because the astronomy is fairly, you know, we have computers, I have software, I can do this. So kudos to the Dorham team for working on the calcium carbonate dating that does in fact work with the Upper Paleolithic astronomy on the panel.
Yeah. Now I know you've given many presentations on this. On this body of work that you've created, and all over the world and and different places and so on. I'm wondering if, have you received any critique? Are there people who say, wait a second, this is wrong?
Sure, absolutely. So there's people coming at it from different perspectives, which is really human nature. You know, one end of the perspective, you got people raising the flag. This is wonderful. And these are people that fundamentally accept anything, right, as we know. And then there's in the middle, we have people that this is interesting. Let's look further into this. And those are the people, the first two categories, the people who follow me on Facebook and academia.edu, all these platforms. So I woke up this morning and someone wanted to connect me on LinkedIn on Facebook, who's probably one of the top five archaeologists in Europe. I'm like, that's interesting. And so the who's who of archaeologists who work in this space have already connected me one way or the other. And they share images with me. But this is interesting. When I first started work on this project, no one wanted to give me images. So I got them offline, right? And then people said, well, I had to buy the images for use. Well, now they actually give me the images because they want me to use because they have their own favorite caves, their own favorite countries, Spain versus France, I tell you. And so now they give me the images to use so that I can evaluate them to promote them as I've been doing. Early on in this project, when I was posting images out there, I was getting lots of thumbs down. And I went back and looked at the thumbs down. Well, the French were thumbs down in the Spanish ones, and the Spanish were thumbs down in the French images, interpretations. And so I realized this had nothing to do with my work, but entirely to do with nationalism and the European Union that has not yet happened. So we have category one, we have category two, and we have category three. There's a lot of people with invested interests, people who are basically in competition with me, even though I have no interest in being in competition with anybody. People, you know, many multimillion dollar grants working on projects. People have, you know, perspectives in their interpretations. And no one has actually given me we'll call it like a solid critique. I get some version of, well, how could it be true if we didn't know about it already? I mean, there's a lot of different ways that one comes out, but there's a problem, because if they say, well, no one's going to say that's not an elephant or that's not a lion or that's not these things. You just can't do that. So no one will say that. And so they'll just say, well, how can we know about it already? Meaning at the institution itself. And what's happened in these last 3 or 4 years is I've actually watched the conversation shift. The conversation shift from older hypotheses were never proven, and everybody knows they weren't proven. And they've moved to the direction of what we're talking about. In fact, one paleoanthropologist did an interview the other day. I listened to her, and she's saying, well, I'm going to start looking at mountains and cave art. this person had already read my book. And think about how to use AI to look at the images of mountains off of, you know, Google, to compare with the images this individual has collected over the years. So basically trying to mechanize what I've been doing visually.
Yeah.
And it's going to work, by the way. It's going to work, what this individual is doing. So these individuals have moved in my direction. I'm invited to the conferences. I've been a wide range of conferences. And people listen. And then they follow me, which is really the important thing. And
that's going to be very, very gratifying, I would think.
I'm going to tell you. So you read chapter one of the book, and there's a scene of the teacher speaking to the ear of the apprentice. And I saw that about, gotta be 6 or 7 years ago, the first time. And that came right after the lion, the elephant. It became the teacher looking to the ear of the apprentice, speaking to the apprentice. And I saw that and I said, oh my God. And I could have written a book about nursery rhymes just about that image, because that was like the core thing. That was the hero. That was the teacher and the apprentice. That was, you know, that was Obi-Wan Kenobi and Luke.
That's one of the things that intrigued me is that you said there was something, and maybe that's what you're talking about now. There was an image that it took you 3 years to see. So again, the title of the chapter is The Art of Seeing.
Yeah.
So there's some imaginal process, evidently.
Correct.
That goes into this, right?
Correct. Well, there's a few things. One is that everybody was counting the red discs, and that's how I started as well. So we're distracted by the red disc. It, in fact, becomes the, you know, people, including myself, couldn't see the trees through the forest. Something, concept of that. That we're psychologically drawn. You probably read the work of Tinberger and his study on instinct, his book, The Study of Instinct. And he shows how people are drawn towards red because it's at the other end of the natural blue-green spectrum. So that's why we use red in stop signs and red in McDonald's and red lipstick, red cars, and all these sorts of things. And, of course, Madison Avenue has soaked this up, the work of Tinberger. And so just like that cosmic mountain comes above the horizon, red is at the other end of the spectrum. And so the paleocavores were hiding images behind the red discs, because everybody was naturally psychologically drawn to the red. So that's one perspective. The other perspective is through psychology, there are tests to see people's perspective. And some people, you know, automatically draw towards lines, and other people draw towards larger images. Okay. You know, the forest of the trees or the trees of the forest, both perspectives. And these are neurological differences between people. Okay. And they're called embedded image tests. It's a psychological term. And so we're all different, and that's really important. So that everybody's going to kind of see, everybody can ultimately see what I've described, but that for some people, they'll die if see it right away. And other people, you know, they're staring at the red disc. I give the presentation.
That's a good analogy, the embedded images where you see the pattern of dots, and some people will see a wolf.
Correct.
And other people, and I have to say, I'm not one of the ones that can see those animals.
That's fair.
And why that is, I don't know. But I do know that it happens, and you know, and that they can show you, you know, somebody can draw the image and overlay it over all those dots, and then you say, "You're right, it's there." So that's, I see that's a very important
Neurological difference.
For what?
It's a neurological difference.
Yeah.
And there's a I believe she's an American artist, and everybody's, we've all seen the images, and maybe you've seen them as well, is you have the wolves in the forest, and it's a winter scene with the white snow on top of the trees, and the wolves are white, and you have to pick out the wolves in the trees. And she does other ones with horses, and she has red horses against a red background of the soil. And you have to kind of count the horses. Uh-huh. And all your listeners say, well, people just jump, oh, I know that, because we've all seen it. And so she's using that same trick, upper pelvic trick, in her art to hide what you see, what she's made. And she's done it intentionally. I'll remember the name probably in a few minutes. So it's a neurological difference, and people test for this. And psychologists, and I'm not a psychologist, but psychologists will actually look at these two different embedded image tests and come up with other conclusions about personality conclusions about the individual.
Mm-hmm.
So I earlier on I said that I'm dyslexic. Okay. And a dyslexic person thinks in pictures. That's it. We think in pictures. So it takes a long time for a dyslexic person to learn how to read, and especially learn how to write. And sometimes I'll write a sentence, and I'll, you know, maybe 10 words in a sentence, and I actually missed three of them because it was just screaming off my head in pictures. Okay. So I'm naturally a visual person versus, a counter.
Yeah. Do you have another book? Is there another book?
I did a book before this. It was Biological Time, and that was all about the numbers and the animals and,
right,
you know, the chronobiology. So do I have another book in the works? The answer is no. And this is you'll probably understand this. A typical book sells 4,000 to 5,000 copies, and that's pretty good, right? Maybe 10. And that's an audience, right? Think about how many viewers that you have on any one of your podcasts compared to any one of those book sales, right? So if you want to reach the world, you don't write books. You go on podcasts, you make YouTube videos, you give presentations that then can be put on the internet. I won't do a presentation at a academic conference unless I can record it beforehand, at least, so it goes on the internet. So the world has changed. And
definitely.
Everybody has a voice. There's no more establishment. There's no more gatekeepers. And people will, you know, they gravitate towards the best or most reasonable arguments. So I don't think I'll ever write a book again, but I'd love to do a documentary, you know, something Netflix. So if any of your viewers has any connection with Netflix or one of those streamers and wants to join together for a documentary, that's my next step.
Uh-huh. Maybe a film of some sort, a documentary.
Streaming is the new thing.
Well, you know, we've had a very wide-ranging conversation here, and it's about time to wrap it up. I wonder if there's anything else that you'd like to get in before we wrap this up.
Well, first, this was a wonderful program, and thank you for having me on. People can find more of my work at beforeorion.com. I use beforeorion hashtag for everything, and I'm on all the social media platforms where I post information. I love people to comment on things and give, you know, the 1, 2, and 3 perspectives. I love to hear it all. And I'd love to hear about people send me, well, this is a link you might want to think about because this offers another perspective that is different from yours or is parallel to yours. So this is a journey. And you know, I'm 57. I have a few years left in me. I want to continue down this path and continue learning and sharing it to the world as best I can.
Well, Bernie J. Taylor, I want to thank you for being my guest today on Shrink Wrap Radio.
The pleasure is all mine, David.
My interview with Bernie J. Taylor really stretched me. I'm pretty sure he's brilliant, but that our typologies are quite different. By his own admission, he's dyslexic and a visual thinker. I experience myself largely as a verbal thinker, and a fairly linear one at that. In the interview, he was quickly moving from one idea to another because he had the whole template of his vision in his mind, and I struggled to keep up. Also, I was concerned that my listeners who had not read his book might feel lost. So several times I interrupted him either to back him up a bit or to state my understanding so as to make sure we were on the same page. Before the interview, I hadn't realized that Taylor had a rather scientific job tracking the timing of salmon spawning runs. So he was definitely oriented toward the natural world with a naturalistic, quantitative approach. Then, as recently as 7 years ago, he discovered the world of Jung and Campbell, which gave him a very different view. He describes himself as a naturalist in the mold of Jane Goodall. Jung and Campbell awakened in him an alternative consciousness typified by animism. So he dives into the cave art of El Castillo with a kind of animistic consciousness, which would have typified the thinking of the early Homo sapiens from 34,000 years ago. In that state of mind, he sees archetypal figures and a recapitulation of the hero's journey on the cave walls. The first chapter of his book is titled The Art of Seeing, which to me suggested bringing imagination to the act of looking. In fact, that idea was reinforced for me when I learned that there was an image in the cave that took him 3 years to, quotes, see. I looked at the reproductions of the images in his book, and I didn't, quote, see everything that he describes. Was he making it up? Toward the end of our interview, he spoke about those embedded image tests in which some people can see an animal or other figure and others don't see it no matter how hard they try. Well, I must confess, I've never been able to see those figures. That model really brought home to me why I was having difficulty being on the same page, so to speak, with Bernie. To give you a sense of his writing, let me read a snippet from his book, and I quote, "Yet a journey into the depths of humankind's origins requires that we dig deeper than the traditional archaeological approach of sediment layers in the cave floor. This journey demands that we look through the hearts and minds of our distant ancestors. We need to feel their emotions, love, fear, hate, desire, and so many more that are still in our basic nature. We must think about what was important to them in an environment less convenient than our own. We must witness the whole of who they were. Only then can we begin to understand from where we come and who we truly are. This is where our journey begins, as told through the work of geniuses from our far-off past. In the deepest chamber of a cave we now enter, the same deep chamber where we only take ourself. The self we must ultimately face in a story that has been told at least 34,000 years ago. A story that is within us, whose deeper meaning may be rediscovered again." Close quote. So if you want to have your own thinking stretched, I commend Before Orion, Finding the Face of the Hero by Bernie Taylor to you, along with the many videos on YouTube of other interviews with him and his own presentations you'll find there.
Hi, this is Paul Krause from Grand Rapids, Michigan. I am a monthly donor to Dr. Dave's Shrink Wrap Radio Show because I love it so much. And I give $5 a month because, for me, that's like buying Dr. Dave a cup of coffee, and that's what I can afford right now. I just opened up a new clinic in Grand Rapids called Health for Life, and you can find that information at www.healthforlifegr.com. As the clinic grows, I hope that my donation will grow also. And I wanted to thank Dr. Dave and all the guests for the years of insight and information I've gained from listening to the show, and all the books I've bought because of it, and the conferences I've attended because of it. I love the show, and thank you, Dr. Dave, for your work. You're really impacting people all over the United States and the world. Thanks so much.
Thank you, Paul Krause, for spelling out the value of shrink wrap radio in your practice and for encouraging others to follow your fine example. Thanks also to new monthly donor Mark Morris and the following who have updated their annual giving: Allison Greenig, Life Career Studio, Eli Z, Full Heart Therapy, and Charles Frankie. Thanks also to all of our regular, longtime donors. It warms my heart each time I'm looking at the honor roll on our site, and I feel so supported by you faithful friends. You know who you are. And thus, it's time to wrap it up once again. Shrink wrap it up, that is. Thanks again to Bernie Taylor, independent naturalist and thought leader and author, for discussing his book and work with us. Next week, my guest will be return guest, Dr. Daniel J. Siegel, one of the three editors of the new Norton book on interpersonal neurobiology and clinical practice. So until then, this is Dr. Dave reminding you to be kind to yourselves and others.
You've been shrink-wrapped by Dr. Dave. All the psychology you need to know, and just enough to make you dangerous.